chapter 17 of Exodus, the Amalekites think it's necessary to take up arms against the Israelites who have just found themselves in the desert, wandering around for God's purposes. You ever feel that way? Out in the middle of nowhere and you're still getting attacked? Well, today's program is just for you. There is real encouragement here in chapter 17 as we begin to understand how God is for us, even when it seems all is hopeless and everything is against us. This is Abounding Grace with Pastor Chris Gordon. Thank you for joining us today. Let's catch up with Chris in Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16. Here come the Amalekites.
I invite you to turn in the Bible this morning to the second book of the Bible. We're returning again to our study in the book of Exodus. And this morning we come to Exodus chapter 17, and here come the Amalekites. This is a great section that'll help us to understand the whole picture this morning. We're going to look at verses 8 through 16 of chapter 17. This is the word of the Lord. Verse 8. Then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, "Choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. And whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands grew weary. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this as a memorial in a book and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, "The Lord is my banner," saying, "A hand upon the throne of the Lord. The Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." May the Lord bless the hearing of his word this morning. It has been one rough go on their way to the promised land, hasn't it? I mean, nothing has really gone very well, at least if you're looking at struggle after struggle after struggle. But the Lord has kept them. The Lord has provided for Israel all the way through. He has been absolutely, I think that's what has been so powerful about this study of Exodus, is the Lord is so committed here to fulfill his promise and to bring the children of Israel home. I mean, it's just wonderful to think about. But little do they know how fierce and hostile the way forward for them will be. They can't do it alone. And it has been a fight for them, you've noticed, in this study so far. As soon as we left Egypt, it has been a fight for them to let go of their own wills, their own desires, and their own strength to do this, and to trust in the Lord. That has been a great theme in the book of Exodus. And this morning, as we come to this particular passage, we see the Lord's commitment continually. It just doesn't go away. This was the promise to Abraham to help them and to deliver them and to fight for them. But he wants us to understand, now that they've been delivered, that they too are to wage the good warfare. They too are to wage the good warfare. It's a really important point. In Exodus chapter 17, we have seen, and what we have seen the whole way through, is that this wilderness journey is a representation of sanctification. The walk of the Christian, the pilgrim life, the journey as sojourners on our way home. We're brought out of Egypt from being in bondage to sin. We were in slavery to a terrible master named Pharaoh. The Heidelberg Catechism picks that up really strong and says we've been set free from the tyranny of the devil. And through the blood of Christ, through the cross of Christ, we've passed over. We're no longer, when we die, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. death does not reign in us anymore. In other words, as Jesus said in John chapter 11, that he who believes in him, even though he dies, he'll live. Jesus has come to destroy that and ultimately will on the day of resurrection. We pass through. We were baptized into the sea. It's our story. We were buried with Christ in baptism. We were raised with him, coming triumphant out on the other side. Raised to newness of life. But then wilderness life began. Israel has still not appreciated or understood the struggle of wilderness life. Now we see that struggle presented to us a little bit differently this morning. Different from how we've seen this struggle. Everything so far has been a struggle in their relationship with the Lord, hasn't it? To trust him. The battle has really been inward. It's Romans 7. They've been taught to trust him for bread. They've been taught to trust him for the basic necessities of life. They've been taught to trust him for spiritual food. Yea, though they walk through the valley of the shadow of death, he is with them. They had a hard time believing that. Remember what chapter 17 was, what incited this. Is the Lord with us or not? Well, today we look at something a little bit different. The battle now comes from without. What do I mean? Well, you know, Ephesians chapter 6 says we don't wrestle with flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. It's just the reality for the Christian life that even though we don't anticipate or we often don't even see it coming at us, the kind of warfare to which we belong as members of God's kingdom is set right in front of us this morning. It is fierce. There is a warfare going on. We talked about it somewhat with the contrast of darkness. It should be no surprise then that Christians who do nothing by way of dependence on the Lord to fight are going to find themselves in the life, in the journey, in the walk, spiritually weak, attacked, stressed, full of complaining, no joy, which is what we've seen in them, constantly and incessantly giving in to sin and its lusts. This has been Israel's struggle. This is their struggle. And it sort of begs the question, it helps us this morning to ask, well, what do we do then in the attack? How do we handle the attack? How do we handle the life of sanctification? The passage before us this morning has the intention of driving us to learn to depend upon the Lord for every aspect of the wilderness way. Every aspect. As he is committed to bringing you home, as he is committed to bringing you to the new heavens and the new earth, he wants dependence. You can't do it on your own. If you try for a moment, you stumble and fall. That's true for sanctification. So I want to show you that this morning from Exodus chapter 17. And hopefully this will help you to understand when people are always asking the question, how do we fight? How do we remain strong? You get a real insight into that this morning through this glorious passage. In verse 8, we read that Amalek, you'll notice here, came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. We need to spend a minute just understanding and making sure we have the scene so that we can kind of enter it and picture it as it was happening for them. They have just had the most wonderful gospel revelation in the wilderness set before their eyes. Remember what happened at the beginning of chapter 17 in this last section? They had complained, is the Lord with us or not? A great trial happened out in the wilderness, and Christ stands upon the rock. Remember? Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, that rock was Christ. There Christ comes out on the rock and takes the rod of judgment for them. Gospel in the wilderness. And out from this rock gushes water that is enough water to provide drink for millions of people out of a rock. one rock. Well, it was Jesus himself who, when he walked among us, said, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. He who believes in me, as the scriptures have said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." I'm going to provide that water. I am that water. What a moment this must have been out in the wilderness. They're there, and they're all getting drink from this rock. What a powerful image there for us to think about, that they are all in the wilderness life, and water is flooding them in hard, dry, hot wilderness life. It was one of the darker moments in their wilderness journey when they complained against the Lord. But the Lord, again, was merciful. The Lord was long-suffering. The Lord was compassionate. And nothing could make him waver on his promise. He was going to bring them home, and he wasn't going to renege on that. Well, what happened is this massive rock had dumped so much water out into the wilderness, nourishing 2 million people. The news must have spread rather quickly. Wells were a source of life in the wilderness. You had to have them to live. In the next breath, we read, "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim." Right then, right there, right at that moment, they came up. In other words, right to the place of their water source, the greatest moment of the Lord's forgiving mercy, he attacks. What makes this all the more interesting is that the Amalekites were the sons of Esau. Esau. Back in Genesis, which you all remember because we went through this, is Genesis 36. "Now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz." These were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. In the wilderness, the sons of Jacob are at warfare with the sons of Esau. Well, there's a long history to that, isn't there? Started all the way back in the womb, didn't it? And here, the imagery here is strong. He sends them, Amalek sends all of his warriors to Rephidim. In other words, the warfare began as soon as they were refreshed with the water from the rock. It's not something we think about a lot, is it? Isn't it interesting that as soon as the water came, here came Esau invaders? You'll find this to be true in the Christian life, of course, that when you have understood salvation, just when you've made some great victory over sin, just when you've started to pray, just when you've made a profession of faith, just when the sinner has been converted, it's then that the devil's right there. We know that. This is how he operates. It's always been that case. I made profession of faith and went through one of the driest spells of my whole Christianity right after. Why does he attack like that? And what is this attack like? I want you to notice here, it's fascinating what Moses would later say to Israel about this great event. He wanted them to remember this event. He wanted them to understand this event. It was such a crucial event. And you find him explaining this event in the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 25. You're more than welcome to turn there. I'd love for you to see it. And then I hear people turning and it encourages me. So please turn there. This is Deuteronomy chapter 25. And at verse 17, notice how Moses explained this event for Israel in the future. Look at verse 17. "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you came out of Egypt. How he attacked you on the way when you were faint and weary, and cut off your tail, those who were lagging behind you, and he did not fear God." Some of the other translations capture, I think, a little bit clearer when they say, "Remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear, when you were tired and weary, so he did not fear God." So what did Amalek do? Well, not only did the Amalekites come upon them suddenly, unexpectedly, they targeted certain people. Who did they target? Well, picture the scene. Israel's weary from the travel. They're tired. Water is flowing out. Takes a while to get back to the end of 2 million people, doesn't it? The text highlights the time connection here. It was right at Rephidim, and what did he do? The strategy was Amalek went and attacked all the helpless, all those who were weary, all those who were the weakest, all of those who were tired, all the widows and the orphans, all the interesting emphasis here of the type of person that the Bible mentions. The stragglers. The stragglers at the rear. Deuteronomy says Amalek hit there. Remember where Horeb was? If I could give you sort of mental image of this, it's on the backside of Sinai, overlooking the desert. Moses is at the front. The elders are at the front. Christ is the rock. They're all up at the front. And all the elders and the strong and all of the warriors, all of the mighty men of Israel are at the front. But who's at the end of the whole? And this is not by any way, I'm not describing the structure of the Escondido URC, okay? I'm not doing that. There are very strong in the back, okay? Amalek comes and hits the back. Are you seeing something here? Who does the devil prey on? Who does the devil hit? The tired? The weary? The weak? Some understand how much they need drink. Some understand how much they need to come to the table. Some have deep reliance on that, on the Lord, His gospel. But then there are those in the kingdom who are stragglers. Stragglers, interesting. It could mean unfit to march. There are those who are constantly tired and weary. They're faint. Who has Satan's, where has he put the bullseye? Let me put it this way. You know this somewhat practically. When a cultist comes to your door, they look nice. Who are they looking for? People who know nothing about their Christianity. That's their number one target. Trust me, if you know something, you get blackballed. They don't come back. I've been blackballed. They hit those widows. They hit the weak. They prey on those who can't defend their faith. I've seen this. I've had to deal with this. I've had to go over and help widows when these guys come. This is sanctification. Let me put it this way. What do the elders of the church often see? Well, you have those in whom it's quite evident that the Lord is their strength in the good times, in the good years of life, in whatever kind of circumstances. They love the church. They love to serve. They drink deeply from the waters. They give their lives in service. Even if they get hit hard with things in life, you have sort of Job-like figures. You have Martin Luther-like figures. They're bulwarks. God is their refuge and their strength, and they demonstrate that. They demonstrate. There are the Martin Luthers, or the bulwarks in the faith, they call them. But then there are stragglers. How many stragglers are in the Escondido URC? How many? How many are not very connected to the church? How many loosely sort of tag along? You have those in the life of the church maybe who aren't here very much. Or they follow from a distance. Or their hearts aren't really in it. It's worship from a distance. Service is kind of traveling at the end of the pack. Who would it be? Is it you? These are the casualties. These are who Satan's coming for. Apostle Paul has told us that people who are stragglers open themselves up to a lot of things. He said that there are some who you have to, in humility, correct, who are in opposition. if perhaps God will grant them repentance so that they may know the truth, that they may come to their senses and escape the snare of the devil, having been taken captive by him to do his will. Do you know that goes on? Have you thought about that? Here's what I love to tell you today. God has a lot of grace for stragglers. How many times do the Psalms describe strength for the weary? Psalm 10. He lies in wait. This is what we just sung out. He lies in wait secretly as a lion in his den. He lies in wait to catch the poor. He catches the poor when he draws them into his net. So he crouches. He lies low that the helpless may fall by his strength. He has said in his heart, God has forgotten him. He hides his face. He will never see. Arise, O Lord. O God, lift up your hand. Don't forget the humble. That is the picture given to you in Exodus 17. What essentially Israel has learned in the wilderness is that these enemies are fierce, and they are coming at you when you least expect it, in the most vulnerable of moments, and that you are attacked from behind, from without. And we said this in our Heidelberg for years. The three sworn enemies we face in this life are the world, the flesh, right? And the devil. And they're too strong for us. Here's the crucial point. Back in chapter 14 at the Red Sea, remember Israel was backed up against the Red Sea, and they turn around. Here come the Egyptians marching at them with all of the war chariots. And remember what the Lord said? Stand still. I'll fight for you. You will see today the salvation of the Lord. That was the salvation event. That was salvation. That spoke to your ultimate deliverance. And you didn't fight for that, by the way. You weren't able to fight to bring that about. You were not able to save yourself. You could not fight that enemy. The Lord took down Satan himself at the cross. The Lord disarmed him at the cross. This is what Hebrews tells us. Through death, he might destroy the one who has power of death, that is the devil, and deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. Sound familiar? He was defeated at the cross. And Revelation tells us, the imagery you get in Revelation is that once the devil was cast down, once the Revelation 12, the one born to the woman, rose victorious, he was cast down, then the dragon became furious with the woman and went out to make war with the rest of her offspring and on those who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. There is a warfare. He is furious right now. He is angry right now. He has been cast down, and he's coming at you with all that he has. Satan has asked Peter to sift you as wheat. But I've prayed for you.
I am reminded of the story of the old man walking to church. A bunch of young kids picked him up and gave him a hard time on the way into town. One of them finally said, "Hey, Will, if Satan were to come up right now, who would he go after, you or me?" To which the old man said, "Oh, he'd go after me, boys. He's already got you." Good reminder today of the fact that we do have an enemy. But even more still, in Christ, we have a victor over that enemy. This is Abounding Grace with Pastor Chris Gordon. Just enough time to leave you with our contact information. We'd love to hear from you. It's always a delight knowing you're being blessed by this radio program. Reach out to us at our website, agradio.org. Questions at agradio.org if you wish to email us any questions you might have, or praise reports, comments about the program, or give us a call, 888-504-8805. By the way, when you visit our website, agradio.org, tons of resource material for you to tap into, as well as links to our other platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Again, all at agradio.org. And that phone number, once again, is 888-504-8805. Looking to write to us? If you're old school, the address for your envelope is Abounding Grace Radio, P.O. Box 732, Linden, Washington. The zip code is 98264. Hey, thanks for joining us today. Until next time, God bless.
Abounding Grace is brought to you on this radio station by Abounding Grace Radio Ministries.
Hi, I'm Chris Gordon, the host of Abounding Grace Radio. I'm also the pastor of the Escondido United Reformed Church. If you are local to Southern California and live near the Escondido area, we would love to see you at one of our worship services on Sunday.
That's right, Chris, we would. And our worship services, because of the heat and earlier darkness, begin 9:30 for the morning service and 3 p.m. for the evening service. And both are held under the tent at Calvin Christian. Well, here's Pastor Chris once again. If you'd like to know more, with information on how to reach out to us,
you can find us on the web at www.escondidourc.org. EscondidoURC.org. The Escondido United Reformed Church, a place where the Bible is sincerely believed and faithfully taught.